Blog Talk Radio.
Well, welcome to Lock It Talk, where you hear about NFL stars of tomorrow, today, and you listen to Lock It Talk right now on the Bachelor News Radio Network, where you will hear about future NFL stars that you guys don't know about yet, quite right now, but they are coming. I'm your host, Barry Barnes, founder and CEO of Locker-Report.com. And you guys can always reach out to me at any one of my social handles on Twitter at Locker_Report, Instagram, Locker Report 100, all small caps, on Facebook, Locker Report.com, and also Locker Talk Podcast on Facebook, or you guys can always shoot me a message directly via email at Barry Barnes@Locker-Report.com. Well, I hope everyone is safe with their families, considering what the pandemic that this country that we're going through right now. So hopefully everyone is safe and sound, somewhere where they can be able to enjoy themselves the best way they can inside their homes while everyone is being safe. And just to be able to bring a little light, a little change in dynamic in situation, I'm always going to bring you guys some great information in regards of the NFL Regional Combine platform and its players and the whole process. And today we're going to have something very special, have someone very special, a close friend of mine, but someone who's I look at as a mentor and someone that's been involved with football, with the NFL for a number of decades, very solid, one of the evaluators who I work with NFL football operations in regards of the NFL Regional Combine, one of the best in the business. The NFL Regional Combine Field Director, Mr. John Valavictor. How you doing today, John?
Great, Barry. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, man, I'm doing fine. I'm doing well. Your resume speaks for yourself and for everyone who normally you hear about the Mel Kiper Jr.'s and your Todd Mishays and all these other guys, the Phil Steels of the world, you know, making things happen for us, you know, with drafts and mock drafts and all that stuff. But one of the things I can say about John, he's actually on the field. He actually sees these players with his own eyes. He knows how to break down film and actually do all the work himself instead of just relying on other people to bring him the information and looking at videotapes. He's hands-on. He just recently had run a great cup with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers as he's one of their Western Regional Scouts. And so, you know, also worked with the Kansas City Chiefs. Several other teams in the NFL, so I just wanted to let everyone know that, John, you are solid at what you do. And so far, how's everything with you and your family during this time of the crisis that the country is going through?
Oh, everything here is good. Family's, you know, in the house, doing some things in the yard. We've actually spent a lot of more family time, you know, playing board games, cards, and those kind of things. Actually getting to know a little more about my kids maybe than I didn't even know, but it's been really good. We've been good, you know. Missing sports, obviously. I got two young boys that are very active in athletics, and not being able to get out and watch them participate has been a little tough for us. But other than that, we're doing good. Family's healthy. Thank you.
Fantastic. That's the best part, that the family's doing fine. And then as far as the other things, as far as football, you know, when the news came, John, about the cancellation of the NFL Regional Combine Invitational and HBCU Combine, which was going to be the first this year, and I was devastated, and I knew that it was going to go this route considering what the country is facing now. But as a football guy, it definitely hit me hard, and to know that there will be some players that will miss out this year because of that. When the news came out about the cancellation, and you think about these players that we get close to, what were some of the things that went through your mind personally and thoughts with the players that were involved? What are some of the things you think they may be going through right now?
Oh, I was upset a little bit, a little hurt. You know, I feel for these guys, you know, obviously, you know, being in football for 30 years, you know, as a coach and a scout and working with the regional combines, you know, since its inception. And we enjoy, as you know, of tracking these kids and giving these kids the opportunity to come to an event at an NFL facility. For some of them, it's a really big day for them, you know, to step onto a NFL field or in a practice facility such as, you know, we were at KC a year ago, and, you know, obviously, you know, Baltimore well. The Texans, you know, every NFL team has been involved in it, has helped us out. We appreciate that, and it gives these kids an opportunity to be there. The way that we've stepped it up in the last couple of years, allowing the NFLPA and former NFL players come and talk to kids about it, really gives them an insight of what the NFL is. So to have the whole process of the regional combines has been helpful for many, and to not do it this year was it kind of hurt because, you know, we're really looking forward this year to the first time of the HBCU kids to give them the opportunity. I think that was going to be an exciting event. And then obviously, you know, the second day where we, you know, have the other student athletes come in. But yes, it gives it, you know, from a scouting point of view, especially this year, you know, with this type of thing going on where, you know, you're looking at pro days, can elevate a guy. To have a kid come from a small school that may not have a pro day, you know, some of these kids that come from the smaller division schools and it's one or two kids, they actually have to go and apply and try to get on a pro day, say at a bigger school, at a Power 5 school, to see if they'll let them come in and actually work out that day. Sometimes it's allowed, sometimes it's not. But to have that kid from a very small school be invited and have the opportunity to come to a regional combine and actually have, you know, several NFL teams there, you know, to watch as long, you know, and us running the drills gives them a really good opportunity to evaluate their stock.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, to be able to see these players hands-on and then to be able to look in their eyes and see the fire and for some players, desperation, you know that this is probably their only true opportunity to really get in front of NFL decision makers, because a lot of small school guys are not invited to a pro day at another school because they don't know too much about them. And then at the same time, if they did get invited to a pro day and their numbers don't clock out with the basic drills like your 40s or your short shuttles, they don't do well there, to get cut off from doing the individual drills. I would say, considering what happened this year, what are some of the things you think that the players that were invited to the platforms or were not, but trying to still get to the NFL, what are some of the things you think that these guys should be doing right now?
Well, I think with social media, you know, and the internet and the things that kids have to their access, the availability that they have right now, I think they should, you know, obviously they should be home working, you know, whether, you know, with the social distancing, I know that they, you know, do it at home. You know, maybe they can find a park for a few minutes, but, you know, they need to be working as much as they can, you know, on their craft, you know, whether it's, you know, running routes or trying to work routes or trying to work your footwork, staying in shape, obviously, you know, staying in shape and being ready to go, watching as much football film, trying to be, this is a great opportunity, really, Barry, for these kids to actually take the time and sit and watch film and be a student of the game. Many of them haven't had to do that. Many of them have been physically training for their pro days. And they should continue to do that as much as they can, because I think once the phone starts to ring and the draft goes through, and you're going to see a lot of guys get opportunities to come to camps, and they need to be ready. You know, the NFL teams do their homework. You know, you can be sure of that. You know, those guys remotely are home watching film, breaking down their players, stacking their players, staying in contact with their personnel directors, coaches, and GMs, and they're putting that stuff together. It's not, you know, we don't necessarily anymore need to be in a big draft room, a war room, so to speak. We can do it remotely. But when that phone rings now, these players are going to have to get on a plane or, you know, a train or a car, whatever they need to do, and they're going to get invited to a camp and show up. And we may not have OTAs this year. We're waiting on those type of things. I know the CFL has just put back their training camp. So when this happens, it's going to happen quick. So guys need to be doing their stuff at home, which I'm sure they are physically, but this is a great opportunity for them to start going through film and studying and being a student of the game. So that's how they're going to learn. That's what separates those guys in training camp from anything else, is who can, in a short period of time, learn the system and transition, you know, the meeting room to the football field. Those are the guys that are going to stick around more than maybe just the pure athletes.
When you listen to Locker Talk, having NFL Regional Combine Field Director John Bonaventure on the show today. John, being around you, I learned a lot. I learned, you know, still learning from you, still haven't got, you know, all your knowledge just yet, but I've learned from you and other guys. And from watching you on the field and the way how you evaluate and how you scout, you're very tough. And there are many a times that when I would think that one kid may have this or they're doing and then have this or have that, all of a sudden, you know, you shut it down and you give reasons why. When you go and start to evaluate in the scout, what mindset that you have, what are some of the things that you look for, whether in a player's processing or how they move on the field or when you look at their mechanics, what's the mindset that you take and what are some of the things that you look for in a talent for any one of the 32 teams in the league?
You know, Bear, I look at all that, actually. I've been fortunate, you know, to learn under some great coaches. You know, when I started, you know, back in 1989, you know, under Vic Roan at San Francisco State, you know, he's a former president of the ASDA, and, you know, he opened up a lot of doors for me. You know, I was able to go, you know, my first year up to Rockland in the summer and watch the 49ers practice, you know, with Bill Walsh and listen to him in meetings and guys like Mike Holmgren in meetings. And then, you know, I've been able to meet some great coaches along the way, you know, the R.C. Slocums and the Johnny Majors, you know, in the early days that kind of taught me. And then having the opportunity to work for Chris Alt, you know, in Reno at the University of Nevada, was a stickler for, you know, the details. And I was a young GA, you know, coach. So you learn the details. So I've been blessed to be around some great mentors, you know, Jim Kreiner's, obviously Dick Vermeil, Herm Edwards. To be around those guys kind of put me in that situation. But usually when I'm at the combines, you know, I'm looking at all that. So I usually have somewhere between 5 and 10 specifics for each position, you know, whether it's stance, get off, hand fight, acceleration, agility. You know, I look at the mechanics. I look at all of that. So I kind of have between 5 and 10 things per position in my mind that I kind of stack for each player. And you know, and I check those off, like on a checklist, you know, mentally or, you know, on paper if I have it. And then, you know, at the regionals, as we're doing the drills, I want to see a guy compete. You know, the biggest thing for me is, you know, when guys ask what I look for, so I want to see a football player. You know, I want to see a guy that has been given this opportunity to come here, and I want to see what he can do. He has the opportunity in front of, you know, the numerous NFL scouts. Sometimes we've had, you know, personnel directors and GMs and, you know, coaches at these events. Then I want to see a guy that says, you know what, here's my opportunity. And let me do everything I can to separate myself from someone else. Because at the end of the day, it's competition, right? You know, we're going to take 90 guys, you know, roughly to an NFL camp, and half of those guys are going home. So who's going to be willing to compete? So the first thing, you know, obviously I'm looking at the skill specifics per position, you know, and the player and the little things. Some of that can be coached, right? You know, some of that is where the kid go to school and what kind of coaching has he had, where is he in his physical development. Some guys are a little bit late bloomers. You know, you always want to, as a scout, try to find a guy that still got something left that can be developed. That's where scouts make their money. You know, that's what you get known for, is finding that guy that you can stand on the table for in the later rounds, which is usually what we have at the regional combines, are the, you know, seventh, eighth, sixth, seventh picks and you know, the PFAs, the priority free agent guys.
Right.
And where are those guys in their development? And to be able to say, you know, hey, here's a guy who's got some tools, he's got some redeeming qualities, you know, he's got the height, weight, speed, but there's some mechanical issues that need to be fixed. Well, I believe in our coaching staff, and if I put him on the table and I stand up for him, I believe that our staff, if he comes to our environment, whatever NFL team it may be, that he'll get the coaching, he'll rise, you know, and he'll be a player and be a guy in this league. But mostly I want to see that guy compete. I want to see a football player.
Right. One of the things that stands out to this day was one of the workouts, and I know that for some reason, I could be wrong, but it's like you really get excited when the quarterbacks come on the field and when they going through the quarterback throws to see if they can throw the NFL pass, throw the NFL ball. And I see that when you have your gloves on, and two quarterbacks, Will Adder and also Nick Mullins. I remember that time when you was really excited with how the ball was coming at you and the spin. You also determined a good quarterback the way how the ball was spinning and the sound. That was the first time I've ever heard that. And for the listeners, one of the things I always talk about the listeners that when it comes down to the quarterback and the quarterback position, coming through the regional combine, why that one is so tough, you know, to be able to judge because they're throwing balls to players who they're not familiar with. When you look at the quarterback position and from just seeing the way how you break those players down, how do you use that process to determine if a player is going to be on the NFL level or CFL level or any professional level from just being at that workout watching the quarterback?
Again, you know, it goes back to the years of coaching, you know, and being around the game, you know, to be around, you know, the Bill Walshes and the Mike Holmgrens early. You know, I had a great opportunity to spend many, many days with a guy named, you know, the late, great Kenny Meyer. You know, for those that don't know him, Google him, look him up. He's a quarterback guy, passed away a few years ago. But when I was in Kansas City, you know, he's a great friend of Coach Ramil's, and he'd come to camp. And, you know, Kenny had an opportunity to coach, you know, Joe Namath and Kenny Stabler. And, you know, he's been with the guys, man. So I would just sit with him and ask him what made, you know, what makes those guys. And he, you know, and he'd give me some things where the great quarterbacks, the Namaths, the Stablers, the Montanas, the Bradys, like they want to be great at everything, and they want to be technically sound at everything, you know. And then going through the combines, you know, to be honestly, you know, spending as much time as I have with Johnny Kaleo, you know, he's a quarterback guy, and he and I work great together at the regionals, and picking up some things from him. But just watch coming off. You know, the way that they throw the ball, you know, watching if they can get, you know, the foot going forward and the hips come around and the shoulders being square and all, you know, all those type of little technical things. And then you'll just know when the ball comes off their hand. You know, I've been doing it long enough that, you know, there's some guys, you know, I don't need the gloves, but at 55 years old, you know, some of these cats, you know, these young guys can really spin it. So, you know, it's kind of why I've gone to the gloves in, you know, in these later years. But, the accuracy, you know, we put those kids, you know, I stand at a spot for a reason, and those kids run through those drills, and, you know, you got to have accuracy. You know, the difference between being open in college and being open in the NFL is astronomical, right?
Right.
You can gain a foot, you know, 6 inches or a foot on a guy in college, but in the NFL, I mean, you got about an inch, you know. The anticipation and the velocity and the accuracy of the top quarterbacks, I mean, they're throwing guys open that aren't open, right?
Sure.
They're putting balls in spots that are so tight, those tight windows. So, you know, that's what we look for at the regional. But, again, it goes back to, you know, doing some homework and finding out where they've been. You know, what's their background? You know, what level have they played? You know, one of the things about Will was his demeanor. You know, he was a leader, you know, in the drills. He was a solid guy. He was coachable. You know, he took to coaching very well. And, you know, I believe he's still up in Canada playing.
Yep.
You know, I think he threw the ball very well. But, you know, maybe he didn't quite have, you know, the zip that maybe some of the NFL teams needed or maybe some of the anticipation. You know, that's a big thing between college and pro football is anticipation. You got to throw guys open before they're open, you know. To play this game, you know, at the pro level. We're in college, you know, especially these young college guys that have the stronger arms. I mean, you can kind of wait for a guy to come out of a break and be open, and you can still zip it. Well, you're not beating NFL DBs like that. So it's throwing the ball early, the accuracy and the zip. You know, and again, going back and watching how do they conduct themselves during the drills and in between drills. You know, that's big for quarterbacks, you know. And they don't realize it, but myself and you know, the other guys that work the combine and the scouts that are there, they're watching those guys in between reps. You know, how are they interacting with the receivers? How are they interacting with the other quarterbacks? How are they taking, you know, to the coaching they're getting from Kaleo? You know, how are they adjusting to all that? And that's a big part of working with the quarterbacks there. And I think it's a great platform for quarterbacks. I wish we could get more quarterbacks to come to the region.
Right, I agree with you 100% with that, because that can be a major game changer. Fortunately, we were able, you know, to get four quarterbacks that came from the regional combine that actually, had opportunity to be able to play in the league. B.J. Daniels was the first one. He was actually the first quarterback to actually throw a ball during a regular season, although it was 7 yards when he was with the Texans in 2016. He was the first one. Then that's when you have Nick Mullins, who really took it to the next level. You know, the 2 seasons ago, he finished out half the season for the 49ers. So he's been the biggest spot. And you had Joe Callahan, the third Division III from Wesley College, and now we got Alex McGould, who's now with the Texans as well. You know, who I really believe that could be like a Tatum Hill type of player. We do have some players that finally came through, and like you said, I hope more will come. You want to listen to Locker Talk on the Bachelor News Radio Network. Joining us is John Bonaventure, NFL Regional Combine Field Director. And, John, I know you've been around a lot of football, and not to hold up too much of your time, but who, out of all the players that you had ciphered through and filtered through for the teams in the league, is there a player that you, whether they currently in the league or played in the NFL, that you felt strong that should have been given the opportunity and they actually excelled and made it to the league? Was there any player that you was like, you could personally say that you was pretty much responsible for helping that particular player to get to the next level?
Through the regional combines or just scouting in general?
The scouting in general.
Scouting in general? Yeah, you know, my first couple of years when I was in Kansas City, I got this call from this coach. You know, I had the Midwest area, the I-35, so I had Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. So I had a big area, a lot of football, especially in Texas. And I had this coach kept calling me about this kid at Northwest Oklahoma State. And I said, you know what, coach, you know, I it's an NAI school, and, you know, you're on my schedule. And, you know, I'll be sure I'll come by. Well, this coach kept sending me emails and calling and leaving me messages. So I started tracking this kid for a few weeks on the internet. And I was seeing receiving stats and quarterback stats and punt return stats. And it was just unbelievable what I was seeing. So I finally had some time where I said, you know, I got to go see this kid. And I drove out to Northwest Oklahoma State and got to meet him. And the kid's name was Patrick Creighton. And you know, and Patrick played in the league for quite some time. And when I met him, he looked the part. And we got a chance to sit and talk. And I put him on a list. I was a scout for Kansas City, but I was also a national scouting, you know, football scouting scout. So I was part of the combine. So my spring reports, I was responsible for, I believe at the time, there were 18 teams belong to NFS. You know, there's National Football Scouting, and then there's Blesto Scouting. I was a combine scout for National, you know, with Duke Babb, you know, and the crew. So, you know, when I put him on a list and I gave him a draftable grade, and then once those spring reports went out and other teams got on him. Now, you know, funny story is we had a kid in our office that also knew about him when I was in KC. Now, I don't know to this day if he took it with him, but, you know, he's a great guy, a good friend of mine. But we really like Patrick Creighton. We're looking at taking him in the later rounds in KC. Well, this young fellow went and got him a full-time gig at the Cowboys, and the Cowboys took him around before we did. And, you know, we all know he played there. So Patrick Creighton was one. You know, I haven't had a chance to talk to him or meet him, you know, since. But, you know, he was one that, you know, I take a lot of pride in saying, you know what, that's what scouts do. You know, you get out, you get the roadmap, you go find the school, and you find those kind of guys. You know, the guys that go on the first and second day of the draft, they're not hard to find. But to find those guys are going to play 10 years in the league, you know, in the seventh round. Another one, you know, that I had a great story or a great deal with was Daniel Manning, you know, came out of Abilene Christian. Mm-hmm. You know, I got a personal story behind that one. You know, Daniel was another one that, you know, I'm like, you know, it worked out well. It worked out well for the situation. But, yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic. Wow, that's awesome, because Pat Creighton, I was definitely a huge fan of his, you know, with 6 years playing the Dallas Cowboys. He definitely was. So I'm not surprised that you had a hand in that, because, you know, you like I said, I see your work hand in hand, and I know that when you lock in on the player, you make sure that you pull him to the side and you have that ear. And when I see that you in that ear, I say, okay, this kid got something, because – you wouldn't be wasting your time. So I can see that. So that's awesome stuff. You know, John, before I let you go, I know you're very busy.
Sure.
A funny story, whether it's something that you saw on the field of play or one of the workouts, let's leave the listeners with something funny, something that you experienced that was like a head scratcher for yourself.
Not a head scratcher. I'll tell you, you know, when I talk to kids, because I work with a lot of high school kids, junior high school kids here in the area. You know, I got a high school son, so, you know, and kids, when I talk to them about what it is to be a pro or what coaches look for, you know, being a pro, we call being a pro, like, you know, being a gentleman, you know, being accountable and those kind of things. You know, it's not about just talent. You know, there's a lot of talented guys out there in all professional sports that aren't playing because whether they're not coachable or, you know, for a variety of reasons. But, you know, one is about being respectful, being a guy. And I'll tell you, one of the years when I was at the NFL Combine, I was in the Combine kind of like a director, like I led kids around, you know, so I had a group, and I had to make sure that all those kids at the Combine got to their medicals, got to their meals, you know, got them where they needed to be for the 4 days. And I had quarterbacks and receivers, and in my quarterback group was that year was Eli Manning. And,
okay.
You know, we were at the RCA Dome, and, you know, if you've been at the RCA Dome, you know, there you got the tunnels or, the corridors that you got to walk through to get from different parts. And then we're on our way back to the hotel, and we're walking through the corridor, and I had, you know, the group of receivers and quarterbacks, and I see Peyton and his father, and they're kind of walking towards me, and I'm like, oh, man, here we go. And we're still in the RCA Dome, and, you know, the Elis, you know, Peyton asked, he's, you know, very politely, was like, Coach, hey, you know, I know we got things going on, meetings later tonight for Eli, but I know you guys are headed to the dinner at the hotel, the group dinner, but we'd like to take Eli. Is that okay? And I guarantee you, I promise you, he'll be back, you know, at the hotel for his meetings with the teams. He won't miss anything. You know, and here I am standing in front of Peyton Manning, and it's a billboard right there on the corner of Peyton Manning, you know, in a Colts uniform. And like, you know, here's this guy asking me for permission, you know, in his city to take his brother, you know, to dinner. And I was like, you know, by all means, you know, go ahead, take it. And you know what? Eli, they went to dinner, and Eli was back. He was back probably maybe 30 minutes before his first meeting. He checked in with me, and you know, when it was all good, you know, and then a couple of years ago, I had an opportunity, you know, when Peyton was with the Colts, with the Broncos, I'm sorry, when she was with the Broncos, I was scouting up there with the CFL, and I had, you know, I told him the story, and, you know, we kind of giggled about it, but that just goes to show you, you know, about being a pro all the time. You know, they could have easily just taken him, said, hey, we're going to dinner, but they didn't. So that still sticks to me of how a guy of his caliber at the time was still so professional and so polite.
Wow, that's awesome, man. That's awesome. John, I just want to say, man, thanks a lot for coming on the show. A lot of great wisdom you laid out, some information that the listeners that have someone who they know that's involved in football, someone that's trying to get to the next level and need to know what it takes and from the insider's perspective on how much it's into becoming an NFL player. I just want to say thanks a lot for joining in. You're one of the best. I greatly appreciate you. And thank you for helping me with my career. And I can't wait for us to hook up again, my friend.
Hey, anytime, man, anytime. I might be heading out that way. I'm hoping my son gets an invite into a lacrosse camp back there in Maryland. If he does, man, I'll hit you up, get some of that Baltimore stuff, man, and we'll be able to talk some football.
Sounds good. I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
All right, buddy. Anytime.
You got it, brother. Thanks a lot. Right. That was John Bonaventura, NFL Regional Field Director. Work closely with NFL football operations when we hit the road to go to look for more talent via the NFL Regional Combine platform. And unfortunately, we didn't have it this year, but the bus doesn't stop. The train keeps rolling in. And here on Locker Talk and also at locker-port.com, we're going to keep on pressing to find talent. Now we're just looking to highlight those that actually have an opportunity this year, but we're looking forward right now towards next year. So as long as you guys continue to listen in here on the Bachelor News Radio Network, all the way until the next process going to 2021, we're going to start getting everything pumped up, but at the same time, still keep you abreast of what's going on for this year. Thank you for listening to Locker Talk on the Bachelor News Radio Network, where you hear about NFL stars of tomorrow, today, and your host, Barry Barnes, founder and CEO of LockerDashPort.com. You guys can always reach out to me directly on Twitter at Locker_Report, Instagram LockerReport100, all small caps, Facebook LockerReport.com, and also Locker Talk Podcast. That's on Facebook, where you just shoot me an email directly at Barry Barnes at Locker-Report.com. Everyone, stay blessed. Take care of all your loved ones. Make sure you're staying safe so that this pandemic can get past us, and then we can get right back to the normalcy that we all had accustomed to prior to all this. Everyone, stay blessed. Everyone, return back again next week. Thank you for your time. Bye.
Welcome to Pro Talk with the Mighty Ova. Today we have with us one of the most extraordinary ladies that I have ever met in my life. Flo Anthony is just described as being busy. She has done more as an award-winning journalist. Flo is a best-selling author of more than 3 novels. She's also one of the original celebrity gossips. She is probably the one that is the forerunner of all of the celebrity inside reality shows that you're seeing today. We have with us a living legend. Not only that, but her involvement in sports and writing and producing and being a radio show host is just legendary. She is who I call the legendary Flo Anthony. Miss Anthony, how are you today?
Oh, my goodness, I'm going to have a big head. Thank you for all those marvelous accolades. I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm great, and you are also a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, along with my mother. You are one of my favorite people.
Thank you so much. Yes, I am. Alpha Chapter, Howard University.
Howard University.
That I am.
Hey, you know, I was thinking about this interview for several days, and I always wanted to ask you about your first column. I think it was Keep Punching. Was that your first?
Oh, yeah, it was. It really wasn't my first column. My first column was actually when I was in high school. I was the youth reporter from my high school, Ann Arbor Huron High, to the Ann Arbor newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had every week a column. You know, we had to turn in, we all contributed to one page, a youth page from every school. So it actually wasn't, my column writing actually began when I was in high school.
Okay. Now,
Keep Punching was my first New York City column.
Okay.
And that was in the Black American newspaper.
Okay. What year did that get started?
Keep Punching, I would say about 82, 83 in there. About 82.
Now, when you started writing that, did you see any leeway into the other bigger newspapers? Were they beginning to look at you from that writing?
Well, that's how I did get to the New York Post.
Mm-hmm.
I did get to it through Keep Punching. Dean Memminger Sr. And Bob Williams, they had, it was called Black Sports something other they had. They called me up, they'd been reading the column, and said that the New York Post wanted to hire a sister to be the agate clerk in the New York Post sports department.
Mm.
And they were going to recommend me. And so, that did come from me having Keep Punching. But then when I got to the interview for the job, Jerry Lisker, may he rest in peace, he was editor, and he said the only thing he could see on my whole resume was I'd worked for Butch Lewis and Michael Spinks, and so they were his best friends, and so that then I did get the job. But I went through a lot even for that, because the guy that they said, I think it was Bob Williams, told me, this guy, Mike George, he works there, call him. And he wasn't, even though he became one of my dearest friends, he was not encouraging at all. And I said, well, I'm going to call Dick Young. And, you know, Dick Young was a legendary sports writer. He said, well, he's never here. I said, I'd call him at home. You know, I've been doing all this, you know, sports PR. I got his number. So then he told me I didn't really want that job. It's a kid's job. I said, look, I really need the job. So then he said, well, to call Bill Gallo, because his son, Greg Gallo, did the hiring. Now, Bill Gallo was the great cartoonist. So when I called him, he said, give him 15 minutes to call his son. And he gave me his son's number at the post. He said, give him 15 minutes and then call him. And so I did. And then that's how I actually even got the actual interview.
Mm. Now you mentioned Dean Meminger Sr. Is that the same one that used to play for the New York Knicks?
Yes, that is the same one. He passed away several years ago.
Yes,
I say
right.
Senior because his son, Dean Meminger Jr., is a big anchor person and reporter for New York.
Oh, okay. I got
you. So now you have to differentiate.
Well, tell me, what was your experience with the New York Post? How did that work out for you?
Well, you know, I stayed there almost 10 years. And I, you know, was promoted throughout the time. I went from being the agate clerk in the sports department over to the entertainment department and being the clerk over there. And from there, being promoted over to page six. And so I had several lives over there at the New York Post. It wasn't an easy job though there, because at the time I was there was only three, maybe four black people working editorially. In fact, we were going to NABJ one year, and so one of the guys over the Daily News said, "You all can't even fill up a taxi cab," which was kind of true.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't easy, but you know, I made it through it.
Well, tell me, in working with celebrities, have you ever had any difficulty with any of them? Sometimes they can be very temperamental.
Well, you mean as far as interviewing them? Or,
yes.
Yeah, well, you know, I had problems, of course, with Whitney Houston. I mean, she sued me. She can't get any more problematic than that. But in the end, before she passed away, I think we hugged each other somewhere or other. And, of course, she didn't win any lawsuit. You know, she settled before I actually settled, because people are now saying, still saying to this day, I should go back and sue her estate. But she, I think the Post paid her legal fees. That's all she got out of that one.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's about it. I in general get along with people.
Right.
So even to the point, like with Vivica Fox and Lisa Rae McCoy, you know, I have deals with them. I call them directly if I hear anything. I don't go through a publicist or anything.
Right.
So that's, you know.
Now,
how that is.
Yes. You've been in the business for so long, and
mm-hmm.
You're a forerunner of celebrity reporting.
Mm-hmm.
How has it changed? Has social media played a role?
Yeah, social media has played a role. You know, all these bloggers have played a role, because, you know, I don't really consider them journalists. And the internet certainly played a huge role, because you used to be out here with a story and it'd be exclusive. You could be exclusive till the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're only exclusive for about a minute.
Right.
You know, because as soon as anything goes up on the internet, it's out.
Mm.
So that's the difference.
Now, you also, you had a working relationship with the great Muhammad Ali. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, it's so funny that everybody asked me that. I just did an interview with my friend Jason Cross the other week, and that's all he wanted to know about. It's so funny. You know, at the stage of the champ's life that I worked with him, it was more moving him from point A to B. I actually worked on the Muhammad Ali coin and Muhammad Ali cologne through Murat Muhammad, who was a boxing promoter.
Right.
And then we would have Ali as guest at fights he was promoting. So, like, for instance, in Atlantic City once, I think that Larry Holmes was fighting Scott Frank. I think that's who he was fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And the casino had said I could have a party, but I had to deliver both Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. I couldn't find Muhammad Ali forever. I finally found him. He finally showed up. But with my work with him, it was actually delivering him from A to B. In fact, a friend of mine, she passed away, Sandra Usry, when I first met her down in Atlantic City, and she had a television show and a radio show, and we came with Muhammad Ali. And she said, how is you, this young sister, working with Muhammad Ali? And I never even thought of it that way. I would call him champ. He'd say, are you calling me tramp? I mean, I just never even, I guess I never thought at the moment the huge deal that was. I was just trying to do a job and do it well.
Mm. Well, tell me about your relationship with Larry Holmes and your thoughts about him.
I tell you, he told my boyfriend the other week, Flo's coming back to work for me, and you get the person that's working for him now. That's my relationship with Larry Holmes. I said that he and his wife, Diana, if they could just keep me in Easton forever, I would be there forever. But, I worked for him. I think for about 4 years I worked for Larry. And he's a character, but he's basically a pretty good guy, character that he is. We accomplished a lot. You know, we did 60 Minutes. I got him on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. We accomplished a lot while I worked for him.
Do you think he'll
ever... And now I'm around him a lot because, you know, I work for Michael Spinks.
Right.
And so we do a lot of events with Larry.
Okay. Do you think he'll ever get his just due? Because if you look at his record, Larry Holmes was really one of the greatest heavyweights of all time.
Yeah, he held that championship for 5 years straight. It was 48-0 until Michael Spinks happened to beat him twice, and he never was able to break Rocky Marciano's record. And I think he will always be angry about that.
Oh yeah.
But life goes on. But he came after all that thunder of Muhammad Ali, and that's one reason that he did not get his just due prior to Mike beating him. You know,
right.
Because it was right after all that thunder of Muhammad Ali.
And,
you know, at one point he was Muhammad Ali's sparring partner.
Right, right.
Even. And then, you know, the thing, though, that last fight that Larry had with Ali, some people think he should have held off a little bit. And when afterwards he did go to him and apologize for beating him so bad.
Right. Let me ask, did he forgive Michael Spinks?
I don't think so. I mean, now we've gone to 3 years in a row to Larry's golf tournament. First, Mike wasn't going to go. I said, look, they want you to come. We got to go. And we, like I said, we traveled recently. We just saw him 2 weeks ago at Fight Night in D.C., and we went to Canada with him back in June. I mean, we're with him a lot now because they're boxing legends, and there's all these appearances. So they get along just fine.
Flo,
I
want to introduce you to my road dog, my buddy. He's covered 13 Super Bowls with me. He's the sports editor for the Challenger Community News, George the Radman Radney.
Yes.
All right, George, how you doing?
Good, and yourself, Flo? How's everything?
I've been doing great, just great.
Yes, indeed. That snow gets you down here. This delayed me a little bit today.
Yeah, you know what? I was out in all that snow on Monday. Because I had to go down to my radio network, and I made it back. By the time I made it back home, it had started to change to rain.
Mm.
Oh, my God.
Well, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed.
You also had an opportunity. You should have been on The View, am I correct? Is that true?
Well, I know that they did want me on The View, but Barbara Walters is one of the main people out there that was blackballing me, so that never was going to happen. Because one of the producers, original producers of The View, was one of my producers at Araldo.
Mm-hmm.
And, so they wanted me, but that wasn't happening.
Another thing that you're noteworthy for is your commentary on The Unsung on TV One. How did you get involved with that?
Well, it was actually Life After. I did maybe two Unsungs. I did the Haywood Nelson one because he asked me to do it, and I think I did one other one. But Life After, I was on, I think, for 3 years consistently every week. They called me up. That's how that happened. They called me and asked me to do it. then I said yes.
Tell me about your thoughts on Wendy Williams and some of the other modern day gossips. How do you see how they have? I mean, they talk about some things I've never heard you even refer
to. Can we skip Wendy? I
would
rather not discuss her. All
right.
I just would rather not talk about it.
Okay.
You know, I don't want to be, down in the sister, so I'd rather skip her.
How about how do you see it in general? Not Wendy. I wasn't saying Wendy Williams per se, but just the modern celebrity gossips and reality TV. How do you see them?
I don't think there's any real modern celebrity gossips out here. I mean, I know you see TMZ, but the things that, you know, even when they had the Paid Six show last year, and I worked at Paid Six for a very long time. It still is not the level of celebrity reporting that I did. You have to remember, I'm the first black person when I went on Page Six to be part of a gossip page, the world-renowned gossip page in general market media. At the New York Post, I'm going to say this, and I hope they hear it. I was very upset. I'm just going to go on the record. When the New York chapter of NABJ honored, and I love Bevy Smith, but they honored Bevy Smith, I think, 2 weeks ago. Now, I was in D.C. anyway at Fight Night. I probably, I guess I wouldn't have gone there if I had to do that, but I wasn't even here. But I'm not bragging. I'm a groundbreaking journalist.
Right.
I was the first black woman in the sports department at the New York Post. I went over to the entertainment department where I was the first black person in the entertainment department at the New York Post. Then I scooted on over to Page Six. I went over there because they brought me over there because I kept breaking stories.
Mm-hmm.
And breaking stories. And so I became the first black person to write gossip in the United States of America in general marketing. And they never honored me. Has everyone lost their minds? Or what? I have never felt so demeaned in my life.
Mm.
And I don't care if you send a tape to the head of the New York chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists. Because that's crazy, because I still, to this day, I'm a freelance contracted employee of the New York Daily News.
Right.
I'm still doing what I always did.
Mm.
And it's just, so I, that's what I think about the gossip out here today. I don't think there's, I don't know if I think there's any real gossip columns other than out here that are black, like I said, you got TMZ, and then you've got, oh, God, she's my soror. She used to be on TMZ. What's her name? I think she's on E! Now. For a while, she was over at Entertainment Tonight, because I was doing freelance work for them and the Insider, too. I could see her, and I can't think of her name, and she's my soror. She's fabulous, but it's still not. Still not the celebrity reporting or the gossip that I did and still do on the radio every day and with columns that I still write.
How do you see, Flo, the Bill Cosby situation? That's another.
That he shouldn't be in jail. That is so ridiculous. He's in jail for paying off this woman that he paid off 25 years ago. It's crazy. How do you want to have an 80-year-old man in jail? There's things that I just don't agree with. They could have given him house arrest. He's not, obviously has not redeemed himself. Mm-hmm. He still feels no remorse. And that's the only reason you go to jail is to redeem yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, he paid off that Andrea chick years ago, and people that were on the Bill Cosby show and working on the set of Bill Cosby saw her over there constantly. He is telling the truth. They had a consensual sexual relationship, even if it was infidelity, he was cheating on his wife.
Right.
But, that he should not be in jail, at least not for that girl. He paid that off years ago. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it seems like the time that we're in now, Flo.
The time that we're in is very scary, because any time people can come back. Let's take, of course, nobody wanted Brett Kavanaugh to get on the Supreme Court because he's a Republican. We didn't want him.
Right.
But for that woman to say that he did something to her in junior high school, but she didn't know where it was. She couldn't remember when it was. She couldn't remember that. That was crazy. So we're all probably going to have to go to jail at one point in life because everybody did something in junior high school. Or they were saying, people were saying, well, he got drunk in college. And if he didn't get drunk in college, we're living in a horrible time.
Mm. How do you
It's a terrible time that we're living in.
Flo, how do you see Harvey Weinstein? That's a guy that...
Well, everybody knew this about Harvey Weinstein, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
This was not a secret in the entertainment industry. I mean, he was using the couch and, the casting couch back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew all this, but nobody tried to stop him.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't somebody try to stop him from exploiting women and assaulting women?
Mm.
Right. And look,
people knew. All that Matt Lauer stuff, everybody over at NBC knew.
Right.
Mm.
Why wasn't somebody trying to stop him?
Mm.
That's a good question. Very good question. And with a case like the Harvey Weinstein case, it still hasn't gone to trial yet.
And it probably won't go to trial because it's, in the end, a lot of it, there's no tangible proof.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? It's because things happened so long ago, there's no tangible proof.
Mm.
And he has enough money to keep it, you know, going back and forth to court. And as you know, the longer things stretch out, the less power they have.
Mm. Correct. Flo, you also had another column, the Eye on Stars.
Yes, in the National Examiner. I'm also the first African American to have a column in a tabloid, yeah. So, but New York chapter NABJ don't want to give me a award. Please. Woo, can they kiss my behind?
I'm going to make sure our local rep knows your feelings on this immediately, and they need to correct this injustice.
It's the New York chapter, though. It's the New York chapter, so, but at any rate, my goodness. But what was I getting ready to say? Yes, I had that column. I had it for a very long time, in fact. I might have had that column about, I think I started in about 94, and I had it up until about 2001 or two.
Mm.
Wow.
Now, how many Super Bowls have you covered?
Ooh, I started covering them in 85. I was there last year, so... how many years is that? 1985. Was that 41 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
This is my 20th year, so you were there before me. That's where I met you.
Yeah, I was there. That's kind of groundbreaking, too. And I applied for a credential for this year,
mm-hmm.
but I think one of my associates is going to cover the actual game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
we get the credential.
What Super Bowl stands out to you in out of those 41 years?
I love them all. But, of course, in the beginning, you know, any time the Giants, you know, they won because it's my home team. But I've loved them all. The feeling of, you know, when my mom was alive and, you know, I'd cover the Super Bowl, I would call her the minute, and I have to go to a payphone in the beginning because, you know, I'm before cell phones. And I call her and tell her I'm inside the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And just that feeling.
Yes.
Of being inside that stadium,
mm-hmm.
and it's a Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
It's so exhilarating, and it's just unbelievable.
It is.
It still is, especially the 2 hours before kickoff.
It
seems like you cut the tension with a knife. It is a remarkable feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you in Minnesota?
I was in Minnesota at the Super Bowl many, many years ago.
Okay.
Back in the 90s.
I got you. That was the Bills.
Right. Oh, that's right. That was
the Bills.
No, was it the Bills or the
Redskins?
Yeah,
it was Bills and Washington. We took a beating.
Yeah, Bills and the Redskins. I just remember the Redskins.
Yeah, we took
and
a beating.
Doug, I didn't remember who they played. Yeah, your poor Bills are pitiful. They just keep going and they don't win.
They're trying to rectify
trying to get it.
Yeah, they're trying
now.
To get it together.
Oh, yeah, they did good Thanksgiving Day. They did good Thanksgiving. I watched the game against Dallas.
Now, tell me, how do you balance entertainment and sports? I know they're both entertainment, but how do you balance the
two? Well, because they are both entertainment. And, you know, I started out in the sports department. The sports didn't make money. The gossip did.
I got you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I know, and I'm back, you know, with Michael working in boxing again. So, you know, I'm back with that again, and it's very exciting.
Mm. Now, and you've got three novels out.
Yeah, I'm working on a fourth one if it ever gets finished. I do, and it's funny, I'm starting a podcast in my radio network, Super Radio and American Urban Radio Network, starting a podcast of my book, Deadly Stuff Players. And, you know, so every day I have to read a chapter. And so the other day I said, let me just reread this whole thing. And I was like, you know, this book is kind of good. I never even realized, you know, when you put it down, you know, and everything. But that's one of my newest ventures, a podcast with the book Deadly Stuff Players.
Nice.
And you can get it on AURN.com. I mean, they have all these other things. Google Play, something else. But it's not quite up and running yet. I think they're doing the artwork, and I'm just starting to record the chapters.
Mm. Well, tell us about your the book, First Keeping Secrets, Telling Lies.
Well, that was the very, very first book. The lead character is Valerie. She's a gossip columnist. She's basically me, because my books are kind of faction, because a lot of my life is in these books, and characters are named after my family and friends and stuff. It's kind of, it's interesting. And her in Keeping Secrets, Telling Lies, she meets Rome Nylon, who becomes her best friend in the next two books, and he's an NFL Hall of Famer turned private investigator, and he's investigating the murder of his cousin, and her name is Charmaine Sutton, and so he's investigating her murder, and that's how he kind of meets Valerie, and they become friends. And Valerie, during the course of the book, maybe five other people are murdered.
Mm.
And he and Valerie solved the crime together. So that started the whole Rome Val series, with first Deadly Stuff Players and then One Last Deadly Play, which is now 3 years old. And I'm putting Rome and Val to rest. I'm working on, it's actually a Christmas novel. Not going to be out this Christmas, though. It's called, a Deadly Divas Christmas Tale. Yeah.
That sounds very interesting.
Yes, indeed. Excellent novel.
A Deadly Divas Christmas Tale.